Hi, this is Matt Dubay, and in this episode, AADL talks to Daniel Jones. Since its inception in 2004, Daniel Jones has edited the wildly popular Modern Love column, which runs weekly in the Sunday New York Times. Daniel took a few moments to speak with us before his presentation at the Downtown Library.
So I decided that I was going to be a writer when I was a junior in college at the University of Virginia. And I was in this situation where I didn't know, I thought I'd be a lawyer, I thought I'd be a businessman. I had generic, expectations for career, but I wasn't any good at math. And finally discovered the English department and really, really loved writing. But I didn't know how you went about being a writer. And my answer to that was to go out west and be a ski instructor for a couple of years in Park City, Utah. It afforded me a lot of time to write. And after that, I decided I'd go to graduate school to an MFA program at the University of Arizona and spent a bunch of years there, 3.5 years there. Still, you can spend a lot of time writing and publish a bunch of short stories, but it doesn't make for a career. It mostly just delays the inevitable 9-to-5 job, that you have to get someday. So I did that kind of part-time writing and teaching and that sort of thing until I was 29. Met the woman who would become my wife out in Tucson. We got married. We moved to New York. And I started out at the bottom of the editorial rung at a place called StageBill, which is a program service for Lincoln Center and Carnegie Hall. Everyone I was working with was like 21, and I was 29. And they were all very ambitious. One of them was a guy named David Auburn, who only a few years later, he was an aspiring playwright. And I think it was only 3 years later when he was like 24, won the Pulitzer Prize and the Tony Award for a play called Proof.
Gosh, I haven't seen that.
Yeah, that was fun. And that lasted for like a year and a half. And then I started getting these jobs in nonprofit communications offices, first at the American Council for the Arts, and then at a place called New Visions for Public Schools that worked with the school system. We had one child by then. We had a second on the way. And I hadn't been writing all these years. I'd been working and in sort of a panic about, am I going to return to writing ever? And I finally decided that I would write a novel before my son was born, which was 7 months away. And I just about did it.
Clock right there, yeah.
I know, I just about did it. And then after he was born, I was, knocked off my book for another 3 months or so. And then I returned to it and finished it and got an agent. And the agent sold the book in about a month, and that just changed my life. Not monetarily, but it brought me back into the writing world. My wife was also a writer and a novelist. But then we had two kids in the city. We couldn't afford it anymore. Crammed into a little apartment, and we moved to Northampton, Massachusetts, doing part-time work still from New York, and she was writing. And she and a lot of her friends were struggling with having they all had small children. They were all trying to have careers and be in marriages and balance all of that with work and parenthood and feeling those frustrations of being pulled in all these different directions. So she decided, sitting around the table with a friend of hers, a writer friend of hers, and the friend said, "You should do a book about that, and you should call it The Bitch in the House." And she did. It was a collection of essays by women. It didn't have very high expectations because anthologies don't typically sell very well. It had a small print run to start. And she went on the Today Show and went on All Things Considered. And suddenly it was like the number 4 book on Amazon and became a bestseller. It was after the Katie Couric segment that it just shot up the charts. It was remarkable. It turned out a lot of other women were feeling this way and they wanted to read stories about how people were dealing with it. So the success of that book prompted me to do a male response, which I called The Bastard on the Couch.
I really did appreciate the title.
And those two books together, because they were done by husband and wife, they were just a natural publicity machine.
Sure.
And they were covered by everybody. And one person who read my book first and then went back and read Kathy's was the style editor of the New York Times, a guy named Trip Gabriel. He was the founding Sunday Styles editor. And he wanted to have essays like that in his section on a weekly basis and invited us. First, they did a story on us. Then they invited us down to meet with him and his boss who oversees all of the feature sections at the Times, or did at that time, and proposed this column to us. It didn't have a name. It didn't have a length. It didn't have a frequency even, even though he hoped it would be weekly. And we honestly didn't think it was that good of an idea at the beginning. I have to say, we didn't understand who would read that sort of thing in the newspaper. We didn't really think it fit.
Well, in the Sunday Times, someone's going to read it.
You can't say no, also. You know, you can't say no when they come calling. And we were a little scared of it because we knew how hard these books were to do, and how to do that on a weekly basis was like, you know, how do you do that? And how do you commission work? And how do you make sure you can meet these weekly deadlines? How do you say no to people that, who you know and who you don't know, and deal with that emotional fallout? So we waded into it. We needed to come up with a package of essays that he could use to sell the idea to his superiors. By the time we'd done that, my wife had dropped out. She was working on a novel. She didn't like the job as much as I did, and she had dropped out and handed the reins to me. So by the time the column started, which was in October of 2004, it was my job alone. And I made a couple of decisions that I think ultimately affected the longevity of the column, because at the time I was unemployed, and I wanted some reassurance that this wouldn't just last for 6 months. And
well, were you also worried that when your wife pulled out that maybe the idea wasn't going to be as sellable?
I didn't worry about that because we were so behind the scenes anyway.
Oh, okay.
It wasn't really about us. It was just about the material. And I mostly worried about it being something that if I was going to commit to something, I wanted it to last a while. And I remember I asked the editor how long these things typically last. And he said he didn't know, but he guessed 1 to 3 years. And I thought, well, that'd be okay. I could do it for 1 to 3 years. Seems like enough reassurance. But I made two decisions that, in hindsight, I think made the column longer lasting than that. And one was to not commission essays, to have it opened up to anybody who would submit, and have an email address that people could just send their essays into. And the other was to call it Modern Love and interpret that broadly and have it be about any kind of human relationship, as long as it's taking place recently or comments in some way on relationships today, but not have it just be about romantic relationships. And some of the other titles we were considering for the column would have limited it to that. And that would have had a shorter lifespan, I think. So yeah, that was October 2004. Mm-hmm. And we're coming up on 10-year anniversary of it.
What is being an editor? I mean, and how does that differ from column to book? I mean, I know with the lazy bastard on the couch.
Just the bastard on the couch.
Bastard on the couch. I'm sorry.
It implies laziness.
It does, doesn't it? So that was submissions as well.
No, that was all commissioned. I had to go to everybody.
Gotcha,
and that's
gotcha.
Part of what made that hard. Yeah, I had to figure out, topics, and I had to figure out who could write on that. And then if it came in and didn't work, then you were really in a bind.
So what is your role as the editor then? I mean, it to me sounds sort of like producer.
Yeah, there's several responsibilities. One of the main ones is reading everything that comes in. And they come in at a rate of about 500 a month. And do people think that there's going to be a lot of bad writing among those 500? There really isn't. It's people who are, by and large, religious readers of the column. They know what it is. They know how to write well enough at least to mimic what they think, you know, would work. So I'm really relieved when I get an essay that's totally inappropriate or badly written or typos all over the place, even though that hardly ever happens, because I can dismiss it and move on. Most of these essays lure me in past the first page. And so that just takes a lot of time. And I think one of my skills is being able to have this in my head archive of what we've done, what we might still like to cover, what's in the pipeline to come out, how many women have we published recently versus men, all of those things, what kind of voice I'm looking for that week, and be able to sift through all this material and find something. And I do it in real marathons. And typically, like on a Thursday and a Friday, I'll read, you know, 100 a day or something like that, and really just go through as many as I can. The second part of the job is, once I pick an essay, to sort of vet it, go back and forth with the writer and edit it, usually add material to it that I pull out of the writer in our conversation. There's almost always something more to the story that I can sense, and something maybe they didn't realize or didn't want to admit to or isn't clear. A lot of editing for a newspaper is about clarity, and readers do not have the patience to be confused. And they're not used to reading a newspaper and being confused for a second. They start reading a story, they learn all the important information up front, and then move on to the details and the color and the nuance and all of that. But they're not used to getting into a sentence and thinking, well, where is this headed and what does the person mean by this? So clarity, 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 more than it, you know, I'm much more concerned about that than, say, a literary magazine would be. Or I don't want to lose readers over that. And there are the Times standards to be aware of, which is how the Times is conservative in terms of language. And you can't have curse words. You can't have graphic sex scenes. You can't have things that are going to offend a broad readership in that way. Next are all kinds of copy editing style rules that I have to be aware of. And there's a backstop of a copy desk that will catch those things, but I need to send it in as cleanly as possible. And then there's a business side, contracts, making sure people get paid, and navigating the Times sort of bureaucracy for those sorts of concerns. There's an added wrinkle lately, and that's that once a month they're animating the columns. The Times has increased their journalists who do video work, and it's very important to have video advertising. And this one video journalist had a brilliant idea of not imitating, of not doing an animated version of the printed essay, but interviewing the writer to try to get some sort of spin-off story, something that complements the printed story. So they would interview this person with an audio technician for an hour and then boil that down to like 2 minutes. You know, that sounds like a seamless narrative. And then they hire an animation team to animate it, and it turns into this sort of 2 to 2.5 minute animation feature. And these have been brilliant.
What's the turnaround time on a project like that?
Those are big turnaround time. It's like 6 or 7 weeks. So I have to pick an essay that would work for that. The video people have to agree. That has to go through this interview phase and boil down. And the animation team, I think, needs... A fast animation team needs 3 weeks, and a slower one needs 3 to 5 weeks.
So you've got a lot in the pipeline just to make that happen monthly.
There's a lot to keep in my head.
Yeah. So I'm curious, in the 10 years that you've been doing the column, what about love has changed?
Some of it has to do with technology is changing relationships, and the way families are shaped is changing, and gay marriage and the speed with which that has changed. It's just remarkable. I mean, it's just remarkable how fast that has changed. And as gay marriage becomes more mainstream and legal, it opens the door to transsexual experience. And that, which used to be this real outlier of an experience, is now becoming something that people talk about and write about. In the first 5 years of the column, this was very striking. Not only did I not run an essay, I didn't receive an essay that from the inside talked about someone going through a sex change either before or after, or someone who was in a relationship with a person like that. And I was desperate to get that. That, to me, is one of the defining sort of characteristics of modern love, a kind of relationship that didn't used to exist. And I was eager to get that kind of perspective into the column. And I finally, there's a woman named Jennifer Finney Boylan who writes for the Times frequently and on this topic. And I found an essay by her in an anthology that was about to be published and was able to boil that down for the column and ran it. And in the second 5 years of the column, I've gotten so many essays of that kind that I have to turn them away right and left. It's just one of those changes where people see it in the public eye. They see it in TV shows. There's a character in Orange is the New Black, and it becomes something that people want to share their stories. So that kind of breaking down of walls I've seen in the column and in submissions to the column and in what I've run. In terms of how technology is changing things, I mean, online dating is the most obvious and the one that affects the most people. And what I see mostly is how it changes our mindset going into meeting people. And that it sort of removed the serendipity aspect of meeting people and that spark and replaced it with an intention of like, this is what I want in a person. And some of us are list makers anyway of that kind. But on online dating, everyone is a list maker. And what I see mostly is how it makes people distrustful and makes them cautious. So when people are trying to narrow, you know, you can't date 100,000 people, even though that's how many people are on your online dating site available to you. So you start narrowing people down through whether it's an algorithm that the company has created or whether you're doing it through your own choices. And people sort of revert to their tribe, you know. They don't think they want to date someone or even meet someone who doesn't fall within their religion or within their race or within their preferred height range and their preferred income range and who doesn't smoke or does smoke. And all of those things, when you meet a person in the flesh, you may be totally charmed by someone who would violate, you know, five out of your 10 rules.
Yeah, exactly.
And in online dating, you're ruling out those people at the start. I'm not saying that that's leading to people not finding love, but it's turning people who wouldn't be rule makers and wouldn't be cautious in person into cautious rule makers. And I'm curious about the effect of that, you know, over time.
So you touched on something with the gay marriage. And one of the things I wanted to say is, can't we just get rid of this word marriage, let the people in their religions deal with it? And when is the traditional sense of marriage not going to be the majority? Or when are the majority of people going to stop participating in the religious ceremony that is marriage?
Well, for the first time, I just saw that there are more single women in this country than there are married women. I think it's 51% to 49%.
Oh, goodness.
So you could say that the tide has shifted finally. But I don't see people not wanting to marry anymore. I mean, I think it'll take a really long time to die. Mm. And you could argue that gay marriage is reinvigorating marriage in those ways. It's too ingrained in our legal culture, I think, to be dispensed with. And I don't know if it really matters if people are married, but people still want, I don't know if we're conditioned to want it or we naturally want it, but people still want and believe that they're going to find one person and be with that person for life.
Mm-hmm.
Overwhelmingly. I mean, I have no idea what the percentage is, but that's in what I hear, that's what, I don't know, 98% of the people want. And that's what they expect to have. And then they're disappointed if they don't. And it's tough these days to for one person to deliver for you for a lifetime. Like, you know, I think it was only 100 years ago when the life expectancy was in our 40s. You know, now the life expectancy is creeping up on 80, which means you're with the same person for another 30 years or so, and you're supposed to stay together for love over that whole time and passion. And everyone seems to want that and want the sense of stability that it gives. And in terms of having someone take care of you when you're old, you know, that fantasy. I don't see that going away, but it's a real challenge, especially for people in midlife to think this person has got to sustain me. You know, if you meet when you're in your late 20s, as most people do, and settle down with one person, as most people do, you know, you're looking at 50 years together, 60 years together. It's a lot of time to keep each other entertained.
Oh, boy. Well, if I wasn't looking forward to it earlier.
But, of course, it's great and should be cherished.
Sorry, I wasn't laughing at the concept that it is great and should be cherished, but just your delivery. So this has probably got technology at the root of it as well, but how are young people navigating courtship differently? And is there any trends that you notice as surprising or disturbing?
Yeah, it's so easy to be of my generation. I mean, I'm 51, and to look at technology and how people are meeting and be judgmental of it, like, you know, the man on the porch, the get off my lawn, I'm the man on the porch kind of attitude.
Sure.
Which I feel like you have to battle against. Like, this is reality. This is how kids and teenagers and people in their 20s are communicating, and it has good and bad aspects. I mean, what I find in terms of patterns is that this delay that most people seem to want now in terms of finding the one person, that one person, that delay is lasting through our 20s. And I've heard a lot of stories of people who meet in their early 20s and they really feel like this is it, like this is the person for them, but it's too early. And so they break up, you know, it's like, I'm not going to be with you for the rest of my life when we're 21. And they think, well, there's probably someone else out there. That's the person that we used to marry, you know. So the person that we met and really hit it off with when we were 21 or 22. And now most people aren't looking for that at that age. They want to focus on school and career. And have a circle of friends and do the thing in a city for a bunch of years or have an office job. But putting off those kinds of relationships has all these side effects because we still want sex and we still want like an emotional connection. So what I see is that people get those through other means, but isolated. So people will have very strong emotional bonds with someone just online. And in fact, it can be the most important relationship in your life, or the one that you think about the most is with someone you've met online and that you chat with, but they may live a ways away, so you don't get together in person. I think the hookup culture is a part of this. I think people want to avoid having a relationship that's going to be too overwhelming too early, but you know, you still want to have physical relationships, so people do, but it's only that part, and it's got to stay contained. It's interesting to see people try to control their emotions in relationships like that. I held two college essay contests, one in 2008 and one in 2011, and these were really revealing. I mean, most of these were not well-written essays, but they were so revealing anyway because people were just pouring their hearts out and didn't understand even what they were going through. But a lot of those in the first contest were about hooking up. And so many of them were obsessed with rules, like rules, you know, about like, I really like this guy, but I'm not supposed to, and I'm not supposed to feel that way. So I won't. And I'm not supposed to feel that way, but I won't. Doesn't work so well. You know, it just doesn't work. There's like consequences to that. But in so many of those stories, when the person, whether it was a guy or a girl, would admit to those emotions, the whole thing would collapse anyway. So they didn't get what they wanted either way. So I see that kind of like piecing out of relationships for people who are anywhere from high school until their late 20s. That seems to happen a lot. And also circles of friendships become the stability instead of a relationship. I mean, and TV shows reflect this. So the circle of friends, pieces of relationships, and then by the time you're 27, 28, 29, and that family expectation clock starts ticking for both men and women, then we turn on the high volume, like gotta find somebody, panic that seems to last from like 28 until you're 32 for a lot of people.
Nice to know there's an end to it. Just thinking about it, it's like, yeah, the 20-year-olds have their friend group that they actually end up living with throughout most of their 20s while they can't afford, you know, to necessarily live independently.
Right.
And then you get into your early 30s where you have some money and, like you said, the clock's been ticking. And it's just, boom, let's get this done by 32.
And now we have the means to, like, it's become normal to begin that sort of hunt in earnest and treat it like a job. And it's like, I don't have the luxury of meeting someone on the street or meeting someone. I mean, I think still the majority of people just meet people at work or through friends or whatever, but there are a lot of people who just kick it into this high gear. And the logic seems to be there's one person out there, they're however many hundreds of people between me and that one person. And the faster I get through all those people to find that one, the better. And all these things have sprung up to allow that to happen. You know, there are people who set up multiple dates and the other with strangers. And that's the other thing that's completely new. Like, it used to be hard to meet somebody and go out with someone who's a total stranger. It was hard. And now there are a lot of people who go out with nothing but total strangers. They've met online. They didn't know them before, and nobody they know knows
them
either.
Vouch for them. Yeah. Yeah. You also see the compartmentalization as the, you know, with the Tinders, it's the hookup culture, mm-hmm. and then you could move on to say eHarmony is the one that advertises their marriage. You know what I mean? Like, there's, the services differ for what you're looking for as well, seemingly.
And people are critical that these are shallow ways of meeting people in like Tinders. The shallowest of all, where you're just like clicking on pictures. But I honestly don't see what the problem is with that. Like, anything is shallow at the beginning. Like, relationships go from shallow to deep. They don't start out deep. Whether you know, they just don't. If you feel a spark with someone in person, it's not a whole lot different from, you know, clicking on a picture in Tinder. So I don't think that's a problem. I think what can be a problem is delaying the in-person meeting that allows the relationship to reveal itself. And people who delay that really long thinking that they're getting a deeper emotional connection online, often like shy people who use this as a way to avoid the discomfort of meeting someone in person. And they think, oh, this is such a deep relationship, and this is someone who really gets me. And the more deeply they go into that, and the longer they do that, the more disappointed they typically are when they meet in person, because the person online, and however you express yourself online, is not who you are. It's only a part of who you are. And often, the people who are more shy often have more of a presentation online. They like the person they are online better. And I think the more you nurture that in an early relationship and the longer you let it go, I see so many stories where people really fall into that, meet months later and are like, who are you? You're who I've been talking to all this time? Like, this is not... And the other thing, I actually wrote about this in an essay for the Sunday Review, is this phenomenon of meeting that person, of being used to getting your emotional fix through a device. And all of us are, you know, most of us are like this. You know, it's more your iPhone and playing with that is more appealing than talking to the person who's next to you. And this one couple got so close online, and they would Skype into the night, and they'd wake up Skyping with each other, and they were like having a real relationship, but it was completely virtual. And they finally met in person, and they couldn't really communicate in person, and they weren't even all that interested in each other in person. And they'd go out to a bar or something, and he would be looking at his iPhone, because that's what he was used to doing 24 hours a day with her. That's where he was used to getting his emotional fix. And being with the person in the flesh was comparatively dull.
So how does this relate to, say, the love letter?
It's similar. And it's funny because my wife and I met through, we met in person for a lunch when she came out to look at the graduate school that I was in Arizona, and wanted to talk to someone who was in the program. And I got offered up as a emissary, and we went out to lunch and had a good time. Then she went back to New York. And we started corresponding, and yeah, we fell in love through letters over months. But it was a similar, and then we got together, finally decided this may be something, and we got together. And it was a similar stark, wait, you're the person? And we were able to get through that, just like people are able to get through it still. But again, it's all about, even in letters, you're presenting yourself. You can't notice body language. You can't notice someone's smell. All those things that aren't really part of a logical presentation aren't there.
All right, I'm going to jump one step further into the phone call. So the love letters died. Now we don't want to even talk to each other on the phone. I think you're losing. You still don't have the body language to read, but there's still something there that we've been able to clean out with the text message. I'm just wondering why do you think we're trying to pull so far away from each other?
It seems like phone calls are dying, but then I'll be taking the commuter train in and out of New York. And everybody around me is talking and saying the most inane hour-long conversations nonstop with their loved one at the other end of the line, telling them every detail of their day. So I think cell phones, some people, you know, prefer to text or whatever, but I don't think there's anything dying about the phone call as a way to connect. There's a natural urge to just sort of protect. Like, vulnerability is the worst part about any sort of early relationship. And there's the more ways we can try to avoid that. And the more ways we can avoid it, we'll take advantage of it. But you just have to be aware, you know, have to be sort of aware of what you're avoiding.
So what's the biggest misconception about cheating, why people cheat? And we'll bring tech back into this. Is tech making cheating easier? I think you kind of know the answer to that. But how is it making it easier?
Yeah, it's also making it easier for people to catch people cheating.
Divorce lawyers do love GPS.
I think cheating has become, like a lot of things, has become equalized between the sexes in a way that it used to be more typical for the man and the husband to be the one who would cheat. And there's a book called Sex at Dawn that talks about, are we really meant to be monogamous creatures? And especially monogamous creatures for as long as we are. And there's a pretty strong argument to be made that we're not, and that it's all just social convention and constriction that makes us that way. And so we're sort of fighting biology to be monogamous, and that monogamy may have to do with having a stable unit to look after children and when they're young, but then it wears out its welcome. I don't know, but it's certainly something that people struggle with en masse and experiment with open marriage. And I often say that the stories that come my way ask questions that are implicit questions. It's whatever the person is struggling with. And one of the most common implicit questions in the stories I get are, how can I get married and stay single at the same time? And it's an impossible question to answer. I mean, people will experiment with any number of ways that they can have freedom, both in terms of space and sexual freedom and marriage, and will fear the consequences of the instability that will result if they do. Because even in open marriages that are governed by a whole list of rules in almost every case, because you've got to sort of regiment the thing if it's going to work, it's all about honesty. But every single story about open marriage also involves jealousy and involves, you know, and then it's just sort of like, okay, is this an ultimately a winning arrangement, or are we ultimately, like, is it costing us too much to do this, and weighing of that. But my God, I mean, like, the number of stories in the media where we're scandalized by people cheating at this point, you know, it just, it's almost baffling that this could be a surprise ever, you know, anymore.
I think it's easier to sell it as a surprise rather than... It's
endlessly tantalizing for some reason that this happens again and again. I mean, it often used to be an automatic end to a relationship. And now it seems to get folded into relationships all the time. They're like, let's move on, you know. And that, I don't know, if it feels more understandable, or maybe people are just more upfront about it, and that feels like less like a calamity. And technology has become the temptation when it comes to infidelity. And you, and often it's just boredom. People are like in their 40s and they're like, this is it for the rest of my life. And their work isn't that interesting, and their relationship isn't that interesting, and they're bored. And the internet provides like endless trolling opportunities. And God, the number of people who are fantasizing about exes from high school and college and looking them up.
I've heard Facebook referred to as divorce book, I think, for that very reason. While doing a little bit of research, we noticed that there was an article you had edited called What Shamu Taught Me About a Happy Marriage.
Uh-huh.
And I wonder if you could explain to our listeners what Shamu taught you about a happy marriage.
Sure. A lot of the listeners probably read this article because it was the most popular article ever to appear on the New York Times website. In terms of most emailed and every other metric, it was really unbelievable. And it was turned into a book, and it was turned into, it's in the process of being turned into a movie. But this woman, Amy Sutherland, is a writer who specializes in stories about animals. And she was doing a book about exotic animal training. It wasn't SeaWorld, but it was a place near San Diego where they train people who then work with animals and get them to perform tricks or just behave in certain ways that they need to. And in researching this book, she noticed that a lot of these techniques would probably work on a human being if they work on pretty advanced animals. And all the techniques had to do with luring and with positivity. And for example, you would never scold an animal for not doing what you want. If an animal's misbehaving, you ignore the misbehavior. You don't ever validate the misbehavior by giving it any attention at all. And she thought, well, when my husband, you know, loses his car keys, I get all upset and try to help him and all of that, but that really fuels his tantrum. And she thought, well, what if I should just ignore the bad behavior, just like we ignore the monkey's bad behavior and when they don't get their banana or whatever. And another aspect of it had to do with movement patterns, where he was always interfering with her in the kitchen if she was cooking something, and he would come in and stick his fingers into it and get up close to her, and it drove her crazy. And she noticed that some work, I don't remember, it was with flamingos or birds, where they were trying to get them to land on a certain spot and not go on this other spot where they were going to the bathroom on it and making a mess, and they needed them to go to another spot. And all had to do with luring them that way with food and changing their movement patterns. So they would automatically, instead of flying to this spot, they would automatically fly to this other spot. And so she started putting a bowl of chips and salsa on the table that was on the other side of the island from where she was working. And pretty soon she'd see him like walking in toward her and he'd veer over toward the table. And the last part was about encouragement and being ridiculously over the top with praise for basic sort of increments of good behavior. And as she said, you don't get a dolphin to balance a ball on its nose through scolding. You do it through praise and through treats. And her husband was leaving dirty clothes on the floor and all of that. And instead of nagging him about that, she would wait until she saw him just put, you know, one sock in the hamper or whatever, and she would praise him. And at first that sort of startled him. But we're pretty simple creatures and we like to be praised. And soon she'd sort of change that behavior too, just by saying, oh, I so appreciate it when you pick that up. And when you put it away, it just makes my life so much easier. It's just great, great when you do that. And he sort of felt better about himself and started to do it some more. So this, when this piece came out, I was visiting my in-laws and my mother-in-law is a big fan of the column and reads it like at 6 a.m. every Sunday when she gets up. And my father-in-law's name is Lonnie. And when I came down that morning, she'd read the column and she turned to me and she said, I already tried it on Lonnie and it works. And I thought like, I'll bet that's going on all around this country today. And sure enough, it was. That piece was just a phenomenon.
Yeah, I mean, the title really grabbed me. And then as I read it, I went, oh, this is just such a positive message. And at the same time, the fact that it's effective makes it really great. So I'm going to end with this one question. Are you capable of being shocked anymore? I mean, have you picked up anything recently and been, wow, who would write this?
I'm pretty worn down, I have to say. I feel like one thing that the column does for me and that I hope it does for readers is make people less judgmental about people who are in situations, different situations from them, or maybe would act in a different way than they do. And it's easier to hear about someone's, you know, odd situation in the abstract. But when you hear them talking about it and explaining where they're coming from, I just think it builds empathy in the reader, or at least that's the goal. If it's done well, it ought to be an experience that makes the reader feel empathetic. And I feel like that's what reading so many of these submissions are painful stories. And writers, people who are naturally writers, will write about anything. But people who aren't writers, and a lot of people who send in stories don't consider themselves writers, they're only prompted to write about something when it's painful. And they're trying to figure something out from it. So a huge preponderance of the submissions are just devastating stories. And it can bring you down a little bit. I can't say that I'm shocked by what people are doing anymore. You know, it's been said, you know, that an off-duty cop will walk down the street and look at everybody like a criminal, you know, and by the same token, I feel like I walk down the street and think like, I know what's going on in your head. You know, I know. It's the same thing that's going on in everybody's head. Fantasies and disappointments and perversions and whatever. It's all sort of a shared humanity.
Were there any submissions to Modern Love that just didn't make it into the book that just kind of still stick out with you? And
the stories that I brought into the book weren't necessarily the best stories I published. They were all serving to illustrate a trend. And also the book was really, the column is about broader kinds of love. To focus the book, some of the more powerful stories that were about parenthood or whatever didn't make it in for that reason. I just felt like to address those things a little bit wasn't really enough or worth it. But no, I pulled in whatever suited the book and summarized stories, you know, in terms of whatever suited the point I was trying to make. People like stories. They make things real for them. And you can talk in an abstract way about trends, but it's not brought home until you actually, you know, see people struggling with that. So that's what I was trying to do by bringing stories into the book, and that's what the column tries to do every week.
To learn more about Daniel Jones and the Modern Love column, visit www.nytimes.com/modernlove. Music for this episode was Make We Jump by Burning Babylon, which you can find in the AADL catalog by going to
aadl.org/magnatune. AADL Talks to Daniel Jones is a production of the Ann Arbor District Library.